Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. At this time of extraordinary turmoil in Washington and far beyond, in this week's episode, our guest focuses on U.S. leadership in a world in disarray. In this hour, we'll hear from Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Kori Shaki. She's a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution.
Thank you so much for turning out this evening at the Marines Memorial and the World Affairs Council to have a conversation with the good and great Richard Haass. He has been for 14 years the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, he was the director of policy planning in the State Department at a really crucial time, 2001 to 2003, when the State Department did really interesting and important work in the run-up to the Iraq War that has never really received the attention that it deserves. He is a Middle East expert by training and background. He was the special assistant to the president in the George H.W. Bush administration. He's been a lecturer at the Kennedy School and quite a number of distinguished teaching positions. And he has just written this magnificent book, A World in Disarray. And that is the subject of our conversation with him tonight. Won't you join me in welcoming Richard Haass? So Richard, you make a sweep of history argument that the Westphalian system was World Order 1.0 and that it's tragically ill-suited to the challenges we face now. For those in the audience who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, talk us through both the shortcomings for our current problems and what you think the World Order 2.0 should look like.
Well, for those of you who were not around at the beginning of the 17th century, let me just look, that was a time of constant conflict, really nonstop intervention. And the big innovation of its day, may not seem like a whole lot now, but then it was a big deal, was that the idea of sovereignty became the basis of what international order there was. And this had two dimensions. This was a world of nation states, of countries, and they agreed, at least in principle, if not always in practice, to respect the borders that they all mutually agreed to and not to change them through the use of military force. And secondly, they respected the idea that what went on inside the borders of any particular country was pretty much its business alone. And this was almost a live and let live arrangement. And this is what I call World Order 1.0, and it was on the books from the mid-17th century, continues to be on the books now, three and a half, 4 centuries later. Obviously, this was a set of concepts that was ignored or violated quite often. Think of World War I, think of World War II, and so forth. But it was the best idea anyone could come up with. And it was an improvement over what preceded it. It is still necessary. We don't want to see a world where borders are violated with force. Think about the two most recent, really large-scale ones. One was at the end of the Cold War when Saddam Hussein invaded and conquered Kuwait. And the other more recently was Russia in Ukraine, taking Crimea and interfering, to say the least, with eastern Ukraine. If this becomes the norm, any measure of stability and peace disappear. My argument is that this is necessary, but to use the academic construct, it's not sufficient. And the reason it's not sufficient is because of globalization. And we live in a world where, if I had to sum it up, nothing stays local for long. If there's some computer hackers operating somewhere, either with the support or simply even without the support of the government, but they're operating out of a certain territory, they can do things that have consequences for every other country. If a poultry farm in the back of someone's factory or house is not properly maintained, Viruses can start to move around. These can sometimes be transmitted from poultry to humans, and this can be the source of a global pandemic. If terrorists obviously operate out of the territory of a country, as we saw in 9/11 with Al-Qaeda, if the government of the time, as in this case the Taliban, don't police their territory, they can then mount attacks over the entire world. If countries persist in generating electricity through the burning of coal, this will contribute to climate change and greenhouse gases, respect no border. If a country like North Korea decides to proliferate not just nuclear weapons, but ballistic missiles, it could have implications, security implications for every other country in the world, including this one. So the argument is that nothing that goes on anywhere stays local for long. The problem is that World Order 1.0 basically says that everything that goes on within the confines of another country's territory is its business alone. Well, we don't have that luxury anymore, because what goes on within the territory of other countries in many cases can be a direct threat to our physical safety, our prosperity, or what have you. So my argument is that while we need to continue to respect borders and not change them by force, we can't see everything as simply local, and we can't see everything as simply everybody else's business. So what we need is World Order 2.0, where essentially governments sign up to a set of obligations to make sure that things do not take place within their territory that could be a threat to others. Now, what exactly they would have to be signed up to, that would be the stuff of negotiation. What would be the incentives to get countries to sign up to it? That's what diplomacy is about. Same for the disincentives if they violate it, or the sanctions. This is the stuff of foreign policy. My argument is that for a global age, we need a more global, this is the intellectual compass that needs to guide American foreign policy to essentially set up the rules for living in a global era.
I want to pick up this point of sovereign obligation. You spend a fair amount of time in the book making fine-grained distinctions between the process of establishing the responsibility to protect and what you mean by sovereign obligation. Will you draw that out some?
Yeah. We're going to get a little bit academic here, but then Corey's a real academic. Look, process matters in this, because what matters is not just the rules, but how the rules are set, who sets them, and all that. And all this comes up, all this makes for legitimacy. And this is the basis of a community. I say this because the phrase international community is constantly, constantly invoked. And one of the arguments of the book is there is no international community. If you think there is, I have a three-word question. What is Aleppo? And Aleppo, to me, is a demonstration that the concept of international community, again, is more invoked than exists. And my goal of World Order 2.0 is to create international community about these understandings, and we're just not there yet. What's interesting is one of the attempts to build some community was done, 12 years ago. And there was a vote in 2005 at the United Nations, and the idea was to set up this idea of sovereign obligation and to apply to countries, how they treat their own citizens and extremists. And essentially the idea was countries should not, one way or another, either carry out genocides or allow them to take place within the confines of their own territory. That was their obligation. And if they violated that obligation or didn't meet it, the international community, quote unquote, had the right, and not just the right, the responsibility to intervene, to protect those people who were put in such positions of vulnerability. This was done after the international community failed to do this in Africa. Well, what's so interesting in Rwanda, more specifically, what's so interesting about Syria is you had a situation where four or 500,000 people have been killed, more than half of a population of 22, 23, 24 million before the war, more than half of that population has been rendered displaced, either homeless within Syria or turned into refugees. And the international community did not intervene to protect people. To the contrary, the two principal military interventions in Syria were what? The Russian intervention and the Iranian intervention. And both of those interventions compounded an already awful humanitarian situation. So this again exposes the idea that there really isn't any sort of international consensus about what to do about this one particular problem, which, by the way, if you think it was just local, it wasn't just local. Think of the refugee flows to Europe, which have totally upended European politics and European order, and think of what all this has done to promote a whole new generation of terrorists, which is a threat to Europe, ourselves, and just about everybody else. So again, it's a demonstration that nothing stays local for long. And it's though slightly different than what I'm talking about, because again, this idea is in some ways a threat to the sovereignty of other countries. Again, my goal is to more take it and build on it, to basically have this idea, what I call sovereignty plus, again, that you have the obligations, not just to your own citizens, but now you have to take on obligations to the citizens of other countries. And I want to encourage other governments to do this. I also want to encourage our own government to do this. This is the work of at least a generation. It's not going to happen quickly. And for reasons I expect Corey and I will get to in a minute, it's going to take a little bit longer than I thought when I wrote the book.
So the reason I drew attention to the responsibility to protect is that you make an argument in the book that this World Order 2.0 needs to have norms, processes, and enforcement to work.
Right.
And you use the responsibility to protect as an example of where none of those three things were actually achieved. So since you picked the topic of Syria, when World Order 2.0 is functioning, what would have been different in Syria? How would this have played differently if Richard Haass's World Order were in place?
So this answer may surprise you. One thing is, it would not have necessarily meant that the United States or anyone else would have said Assad must go. Because under my thinking, that was not an unacceptable situation. Don't get me wrong, I did not hold a lot of respect or enthusiasm for Mr. Assad even 6 or 7 years ago, but I don't think it was an essential building block of international relations that he go. And I also think, just as a foreign policy aside, you run into big time trouble anytime there's a gap between your rhetoric and your what you're prepared and able to do. So to say he must go and then not to be prepared to do much to make it happen, and not necessarily being in a position, even if you were able to get rid of him, to make sure that something better would take its place, that team seemed to me irresponsible. So we were acting in a way, I thought, that was undisciplined and inconsistent with the ideas of what I'm talking about. But once we went down that path and things started to happen, I would say there are at least two moments when some of my thinking would have kicked in. One is the one we're discussing, when the treatment of Syrian people would have reached a point of sufficient severity that we're not just talking about the infringement of human rights. We're talking about mass loss of life, mass displacement. One could have argued that this was a sufficient threat, not just to the principal, but again, because of refugees and the rest, that this would have argued for a bit more international involvement. Secondly, when the Syrians use chemical weapons, and if one of the principles of world order, I would say, of the future has to be that weapons of mass destruction don't spread, and if they do spread, they can't be used, and you want to discourage their use, when Syria, despite American warnings not to use them, did so, not acting at that point, I believe, undermined the norm and the practice about weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, you know, it's interesting, we have hundreds of people, if not thousands of people in the U.S. government whose business it is, and Corey knows this from her experience, whose business it is to thwart proliferation or to promote non-proliferation. And we do it through all these mechanisms. But when you take a step back, what's really interesting is we have sent a very large message in recent year that nuclear weapons are valuable.
Right.
What have we done? You know, Ukraine gives up its nuclear weapons after the end of the Soviet Union. The world makes a commitment to Ukraine's security in the Budapest Accord, and then what happens? Ukraine gets invaded by Russia. The world doesn't lift much of a finger to do anything about it. Muammar Gaddafi was the poster child of responsible non-proliferation. He gave up his weapons. What happens? We didn't like what was going on internally, and we and the Europeans oust him. Practice regime change in Libya. Iraq, the Iraqis didn't have nuclear weapons, as it turned out. What happens years later? Saddam Hussein gets ousted in the 2003 war. Meanwhile, North Korea has nuclear weapons, and we're now in the third generation of Kims who are running North Korea. And shall we say there hasn't, for those of you who believe in the natural progress of a history, I think North Korea is a challenge to your theory. Even though, I won't go on.
Here, let me save you.
I'll just get in trouble. But so anyhow, so I think Syria has been an example where concepts of world order in these specific cases have been badly set back by both what we've done and haven't done. And I also think it's been a setback in another way, which is the prestige of the United States has been badly wounded. I think any time the United States, again, allows major gaps to grow, to emerge between it, what it pledges to do and what it does, I think it sends terrible signals about our credibility and reliability. And Syria, therefore, has had repercussions, not just for the region, but I think for the world writ large.
One of the most powerful parts of the book for me is when you talk about the costs of inaction. Yeah. And in particular, the Libya example really sings in the book. Will you talk a little bit more about what might have been done?
Sure.
For me, you make the incredibly important point that Libyans have probably suffered more casualties from our intervention than they would have suffered had we not intervened in Libya. Talk us through that.
Yeah, well, Libya was both an example of errors of commission and omission. We both did too much and then we did too little. I've been through in painstaking detail the run-up to the American-European intervention in Libya, and I would just simply say it's not clear to me it was warranted. Now, again, it doesn't mean I support the rule of Muammar Gaddafi. Like any other rational or fair-minded person, I did not. On the other hand, when people use violence against the government, I do think, you know, you can argue lots of things, but governments do have the right to resist to maintain themselves. And the U.S.-European intervention was launched on the idea that if we didn't act, there was going to be a massacre. I think the evidence of that is really thin. And I've been through the evidence in some detail. So my own sense is we erred in going in. And then when we went in under one premise to protect people, and instead we turned it into something very different, a process not of humanitarian protection under the responsibility to protect, but it became regime change. And for both the Russians and the Chinese in particular, this was a major bait and switch. And if there were a vote in the UN today, you could not get the votes today that you had in 2005 about any norm of a responsibility to protect. So ironically enough, the intervention discredited the very norm it was meant to showcase. Then afterwards, after we went in, so you have the ouster of the regime, and people who knew even a modicum of Libyan history were basically saying centrifugal tendencies or forces in this country, which doesn't have a great history of existing in a unitary way, these forces were going to take hold. And rather than follow up the intervention, we did not. And we simply, out of some either misunderstanding of the dynamics of Libya, optimism on steroids, or simply also a real desire not to get quote-unquote too involved, we held back. And the result, if you will, is a failed state. And far, far more people have died. Even if the worst premises of those who said we have to intervene had come true, far more people have died subsequently in Libya than would have been. And by the way, the same thing, I would argue, happened in Syria and elsewhere. And one of the lessons in the Middle East is just because the situation is bad doesn't mean it can't get worse. You know, there's an idea and sometimes it's through acts of commission or omission. You know, in medicine, one of the interesting ideas is there's a concept of iatrogenic disorders. It's basically when you go into a hospital and you get a staph infection. You're there in the name of getting treated to get better, and in the course of the treatment, things get worse. Well, that happens in diplomacy as well. Often things are done. Whatever the high-mindedness of why it was done, the consequences, unintended or what have you, can often make bad situations worse. My argument in this book is simply that what you don't do can be every bit as important as what you do. And the irony of the last two presidents, I would argue, is we had one president, George W. Bush, 43, who a lot of historians will probably argue did too much in the case of the 2003 Iraq War, followed by a president who overreacted. And I believe that Barack Obama's historical legacy will be as a president who, for the most part, did too little, thought that things would essentially sort themselves out, good would triumph over evil, and alas, he was proven wrong on multiple occasions.
So since you make a systemic discussion about the nature of the international order, the relationship between great powers has tended to define the international order. And you make some very interesting policy prescriptions in the book for what should be the nature of our interaction with Russia and China, and in particular, that more restraint is necessary on the part of the United States in dealing with both these powers. Can you take each of them separately and Sure. talk us a little through?
Be happy to. Just to say that one of the distinguishing features of this age, for the most part, has been that great power dynamics haven't been that bad. I mean, even though U.S.-Russian relations are pretty scratchy now and there's friction with U.S.-China, this pales in comparison to what we saw in most of the 20th century. Indeed, this is the intellectual puzzle that led me to write this book. Why are things not better than they are if the principal driver of history is noticeably missing? If great power confrontation and conflict has been the principal driver of history for the last 3.5-4 centuries, after the Cold War, it was largely missing from the world, why are things not better? And my own view, it has to do with how power has spread around the world into many hands, how decision-making has become more decentralized, globalization is essentially untamed. And these are the forces that I think increasingly define the world. But now we do have a reintroduction of some familiar elements of great power friction. Fundamentally different, though, the Chinese and Russian dynamics, fundamentally different. In the case of Russia, you have a country, by the way, roughly 1/9 or 1/10 the population of China. So just get a sense of scale here. Russia's what, 140, 145 million people? China's 1.3 billion people. So the scale's about almost 10 to 1. Russia's economy is very narrowly based. Large elements of oil and gas. It's not an integrated country, economically or otherwise, in the region for the most part. For lots of reasons, the Russians are cranky about the last 25 years, feel humiliated by the loss of the Cold War, by NATO enlargement, the way they've been treated at times. Economy doesn't have much to show for itself the last 10 years. It's probably shrunk close to, 10%, give or take, with the falling of oil and commodity prices. And I think Mr. Putin has tried to reclaim, I'd almost say he wants to make Russia great again. Or he wants to make Russia perceived as great again, which is actually an important difference. He doesn't really want to reform the country, but he wants to reform perceptions.
It's a nice distinction.
Of the country. And he wants Russia to be feared, respected, or some combination. Wants to reestablish a kind of Russian influence over its quote-unquote near... He wants Russia to be forced to be reckoned with again. And this obviously plays well domestically. I think he's done it now in Ukraine. And he's also done it in Syria. And he wants to push back potentially even more in Europe, but possibly against NATO Europe, elsewhere. And so what do we do about this? So it seems to me it's twofold. On one hand, I don't think we should go about trying to alienate or isolate or humiliate Russia. That doesn't work. I think we should be willing to work with them, to talk to them. I'm not sure that sanctions in the long run should be such a dominant foreign policy tool, because again, it isolates them. I'm looking to integrate them more, so hopefully they would feel some more restraint. On the other hand, we've also got to push back. And I would think that we want to remilitarize NATO. One of the decisions we made after the end of the Cold War was to essentially strip NATO of most of its military capability. And I don't think we can survive in an age simply based upon Mr. Putin's concept of self-restraint. So I would argue we need to reintroduce a level of military capability into NATO. This was started in the last year or two of the Obama administration. It needs to be continued and even intensified. I would say we want to do a little bit more for Ukraine in the area of defensive arms. And there's other things I would hold off on. I can imagine Mr. Putin's very worried that we want to start a political revolution in his country. I would reassure him on that. Again, that would be inconsistent with my idea of World Order 2.0. I would hold off at least for the time being, on more NATO enlargement, I would basically be willing to have a broad-ranging conversation with him on the ground rules for a new era of this relationship, but it's got to be based on changes in Russian behavior, which I think will only be brought about in part by being tougher with them, but also be willing to work with them a bit. So it's got a combination there. China is a fundamentally different case in that China, unlike Mr. Putin, China doesn't really want to overturn large aspects of the existing world. It's not a revolutionary power. It's not a cranky power. China is it's a growing power, and Deng Xiaoping has had the greatest influence on China in the sense that China wants a stable world and region so we can continue to focus on political and economic development. Indeed, the Chinese leader this year, what is his priority? His priority is not a crisis with the United States. His priority is stability, because this October, there's the 19th Party Congress of China, Communist Party, and he wants to consolidate his political position. He wants to repopulate the Politburo, in particular the Standing Committee of the Politburo. So I think more broadly, our goal with China ought to be to integrate it and to get it to work with us in dealing with regional problems like North Korea's nuclear missile programs. Because without Chinese help, our options are really, really unattractive. We want to get China to work with us on global issues, from trade to climate change. What this would mean on our point, though, is some restraint. One of the areas of restraint is an area where we have not shown great restraint in the last 2 weeks, which is called Taiwan. For the last 45 years since the early 70s, the United States and Taiwan have finessed a difference. And the difference is this question of how does one deal with Taiwan, which became the Republic of China after the Chinese Civil War. And we agreed in the Nixon-Kissinger diplomacy and the so-called Shanghai Communique of the 70s that there would be a one-China policy. And the whole idea was there was one China. This question of the political status of Taiwan was left in abeyance. And the idea that, again, that the only important thing was that the status of Taiwan would not be changed through intimidation or force. And this has been a situation which didn't solve the question of Taiwan's long-term status, but it allowed Taiwan to flourish economically, to thrive politically, so now it's a real democracy. And in the meantime, it's allowed the United States and China to avoid a conflict over Taiwan and go about developing a bilateral relationship, which has served both countries well. I would believe we need to continue to exercise restraint in this area, not violate the terms of the one China policy. I think we would want to show some restraint in avoiding a trade war. China also has to show some restraint in some of the things it does and doesn't do. But I would basically think that it's a fundamentally different dynamic because China is integrated into the world economy, I believe, wants to continue to be integrated in the world economy. I don't think China has a policy of trying to overthrow the international order. I think it wants to join it, in some cases on existing terms, in some cases on reform terms. So I am not a pessimist about U.S.-China relations. There's a whole school of thought that believes that there's an inevitability of confrontation between the rising power, China, and the existing great power, the United States, and I would simply say that's not inevitable. Indeed, I'd make a larger point that very little is inevitable in history. I've now worked for four presidents, for Mr. Carter, Mr. Reagan, and both Messrs. Bush, and my own view from having watched it up close is very little is baked into the cake. The ideas people bring with them, and then the decisions they make shape an awful lot of history. And I don't believe we would have gotten to where we are today, what I call a world of disarray, had certain people not made certain decisions to do or not do things. And I'd say the same thing in the future. I don't believe the U.S.-Chinese relationship is necessarily confrontational, or I don't believe we necessarily head towards a new Cold War. I think a lot depends upon the content of our diplomacy. And that's the good news, that there's big upsides out there. And the bad news is those upsides may not be harvested. They may not be realized.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's in conversation with Corey Shockey, who's a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public and conversations that matter. And now back to our conversation.
So we have an avalanche of great questions here, and I'm going to start plowing through them. We have about 30 minutes more in our time together. The first question is, you mentioned in a Washington Post article published April 23rd that the...
Someone's done their research.
April 23rd, 2014.
Oh, wow. Someone's really done...
This is from Michael Chang from Mills High School, by the way, who did do his research. Well done, Michael. That the U.S. economic standing is and will be peerless in comparison with China. Do you still hold that outlook subsequent to the U.S. withdrawal from TPP and the possible construction of the wall?
Look, the United States, you know, economy is second to none by any and every measure. And we've continued to grow, not at the same clip as China, but the reason is that China starts from a much lower base. But you know, our economy has been doing, compared to a lot of other the advanced developed economies, I put it in the not bad department. I think there's lots of, or at least some, unrealized upside. And I can imagine some of that happening with some infrastructure spending, some lower corporate taxes and repatriation of corporate profits, some reform on the regulatory side, and so forth. What worries me, though, is in the Wall Street Journal just the other day, I can't remember the date, but it was January something, called trade policy the Achilles heel of this administration's economic growth policy. And I agree with that. And we have someone like Laura Tyson here who knows more about trade than about anybody I know. And but worries me is we're giving away, we've essentially given away the, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this would have created a new set of trading arrangements with what, countries that represent more than 40% of global GDP. And what will take its place will not be nearly as good for us or for the world. So instead of having a race to the top, I worry we're going to have a race to the bottom. U.S. tariffs are far lower to begin with than others, so we lost the chance to lower others. We were already giving people extraordinary access into this country. So I feel that we gave away a certain degree of economic upside there for what I don't see. The Mexico situation, you know, Mexico is one of our three largest trading partners, along with China and Canada. And this idea that we would institute a 20% tariff is a 20% tax on American consumers. I don't see what good whatsoever that would do. Let me just make a larger point where I think trade has become unfortunately scapegoated, that, you know, you don't get a chance to vote on globalization, but trade and immigration are two policies, in a sense, you do get a chance to vote on. And I think the Brexit vote was in many ways a reaction to immigration concerns, in reaction in particular to what happened in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. And I think here a lot of the frustrations with trade are more, trade against being scapegoated for a lot of job disappearance, some of which has to do with trade, but much of which has to do with technological innovation and productivity improvements. And I just think there's this has been chosen. And you know, those who lose their jobs feel that for understandable reasons with great intensity. The rest of us who benefit from trade, from greater choice, greater quality, lower prices, and even export-oriented jobs, don't often bring to the political marketplace comparable intensity. And that's just where we are. So, but I think if we're not careful, we're 4% of the world's population, just over 20% of the world's economic output. We will not thrive, and we will start shaving off big dimensions of our potential growth if we end up in a world without trading agreements, new trading agreements, and also if we end up in trade-related conflicts with countries like China and Mexico. I'm not saying there aren't reforms that need to be done to deal with property theft or currency manipulation. I'm not saying that, you know, that adequate things have been done to enforce existing trade rules, but we have got to be very careful if we essentially deny ourselves this one tool.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I saw a very good study from the Peterson Institute for International Economics suggesting that only 14% of job losses were the result of trade agreements. 85% of job losses were the result of technological innovation. So there's a lot of scapegoating going on by leaders of both parties. And that's how we get to a place where the majority of Americans actually understand that free trade's in our interest, but the intensity of preference of its opponents is what's carrying the day. The next question is about Kosovo, which is, was it not an example of changing borders by military means? Why should Putin not have interpreted that intervention as precedent for their intervention in Ukraine?
Well, Kosovo was different in lots of ways. And basically, this is Kosovo was one of the pieces of the old Yugoslavia. And you know, when it began to break up, what you had were a number of conflicts between the central government and components, because Yugoslavia was a patchwork quilt of, what was it, six component parts? And my memory's a little bit, you had seven? Okay, it's only one off. And the question was, it raises an interesting issue. If parts of countries want to split up, should they have the right to? And it's something I go on at great length in the book. And I say the bottom line is sometimes. And I think it's very, very hard to say, and every time, should parts of countries have the right to secede? And how does the world deal with it? There was a time in history when we always were supportive of decolonization, you know, when countries were seeking independence, but that's different than countries breaking up. But in the case of Yugoslavia, there were questions about the creation of the country, given the history. There were ethnic issues, there were historian issues, there was mistreatment by the central government. So I believe for those and other reasons, there was a sufficient basis for the desire of Kosovo for independence, particularly given the behavior of the central government.
Do you believe that the issue of ISIS will help unite world powers? And if so, how could this be accomplished?
Look, I think opposition to terrorism is an element of what I would call World Order 2.0. And ISIS, you know, is a pretty good example of a terrorist group that most major powers would agree is, in fact, a terrorist group. So where I think consensus breaks down a little bit is how to deal with it and what would take its place. So imagine you do defeat ISIS in Syria, which will probably happen within the next year, in the sense that the ISIS concentration and control over territory near the area of Raqqa in Syria will probably be destroyed. A lot of these people will scatter. Hopefully a lot will be killed. The question then is, what takes its place? Is it the Syrian government? Is it various other groups? So I think there's an agreement in principle to go after groups like ISIS, but there's sometimes less of an agreement in practice about what would be the aftermath.
So given your emphasis on more restraint in great power relations, can you see opportunities for us and the Russians to cooperate on Syria, and what might that look like?
I can see some opportunities in Syria and elsewhere. I mean, outside of Syria, again, conceivably something with North Korea, conceivably something in Afghanistan. And Syria, look, I think what we're looking for is a Syria. I don't think Russia signed on for a massive intervention. I don't think they're going to help the government there reestablish its control over the entire country. They don't want lots of Russians being brought home in body bags, as was the case in Afghanistan. So now that the government has been shored up by the Russian and Iranian interventions, it still leaves open the question of what comes next. So I don't think it's inconceivable that over time the United States and Russia, I don't think that Mr. Putin has decided that Mr. Assad has to permanently be a part of Syria. And I would be open to conversations about political transitions in Syria. I'd be open to conversations about aftermaths to ISIS's control of Raqqa. I don't know if we could agree to anything, but you know, we are where we are. The government for the time being has been shored up. And So I'd be open to the conversation. But my hunch is no one's going to have any quote unquote solution to Syria. The idea that Syria is going to go back to be a normal country, where you have a central government that's in control of every square inch of Syrian territory and the borders are universally respected and recognized. No, I think that'd be like putting Humpty Dumpty together again, and I just don't think that's going to happen.
So several of the questioners take various tacks at the issue of the domestic constraints on executing the Global Governance 2.0 that you talk about. Mm-hmm. And I want to pick one of the several, which is your prescription for a future U.S. foreign policy would seem to fly in the face of increased nationalism, isolationism in the U.S., U.K., and various EC countries. Mm-hmm. How do you propose to convince President Trump to change course?
Well, I'd say two things. It does fly in the face of isolationism. It does fly in the face of protectionism. So I don't know. I agree. And I think that if we're determined to be isolationists and protectionists, we're not going to have a large role in bringing about this world that's more organized to deal with globalization, and I don't think it will happen without us. I just make a side note, which is the world is not self-organizing. There's no one else ready and able to do it, and the alternative to a U.S.-led world is a nobody-led world, and it's going to be a world of increasing disarray, and I think that's just a fact of life. Yeah, and I think the new administration has to, again, if they persist in a narrow definition of America first, again, this is not going to happen. Again, you need to have a larger vision that what happens out there affects what's here, and then we need to do things not as an act of philanthropy, but as an act of self-interest. And that's what it will take. But if this administration is committed to a narrow concept of America first, is against trade agreements, is unwilling to meet certain kinds of alliance commitments, none of what I'm talking about will happen. And then you'd have to wait for others to try to promote it, or maybe its successors. But it will definitely slow it down, and then whoever is the next president will inherit a world of even greater disarray than this president inherited.
Next question is about where you would draw the line on infringing on another country's sovereignty to aid that country's people if they were suffering human rights violations.
Well, that's sort of the core question of the responsibility to protect. What's the threshold? And I would just simply say it has to be high, because again, you don't want to have a world of constant interventions, and you'd have to be confident that you could actually, you'd have to be both ready and able to do things. Again, it's not enough to want to do good. You have to be able to do good. Feasibility is every bit as important as desirability when it comes to foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. So several questions are about cybersecurity.
Okay.
And as that is one of the major elements of your policy agenda for for ending the disarray. Yep. Could you talk a little bit about cyber and also about the divide between Silicon Valley CEOs and American foreign policy?
Okay. Look, cyberspace is this new domain of international relations, and it's a perfect example of where new technologies come along. It has multiple uses and multiple actors using it, and there's a gap or a lag between the technology and what it does and the rules. And one of the goals of foreign policy ought to be to figure out what the rules are. We don't want to have a world of unconstrained cyber attacks, whether it's North Korea against Sony or what Russia did in our election. We want to regulate it. It's a little bit right now, I would describe it as the Wild West without much of a sheriff. And that's dangerous. And the question then is, what rules are we going to try to promote? What rules are we prepared to live by? And so forth. But yes, I think one of the sustained diplomatic efforts ought to be to come up with, it's incredibly complicated. We had an analogous challenge when nuclear weapons were introduced in the world in the 40s and 50s, and this is orders of magnitude more difficult, given how many players there are, how fast the technology is changing, the much larger civilian use and so forth. This is as tough a design problem And then you've got the implementation problem, as anything that's out there in the field. Doesn't mean you shouldn't work on it, but it's going to be tough. And there's real differences in outlook, needless to say, from those who want free flows of information to those who don't. So this is important. I forgot the second half of your question. Sorry, Corey.
It was about the gap between the perspective of Silicon Valley business people and American farmers.
We just published a report on it at the Council on Foreign Relations on essentially more of a partnership between the companies and the government. Look, let me say two things on it. One is there's almost no single person who's got the background on this issue. You got the technology people, you got the international relations people, you got commercial people, you got the legal people. We've got to bring a lot of them in the room, and you've got to work this out because there are competing considerations. And in the case of Silicon Valley, there's commercial versus security, there's individual privacy versus collective security. So there's no single right answer. This is going to have to involve trade-offs and compromises, but you can't do this. Government alone can't do this. But on the other hand, the companies can't just be left on their own to do what they think is right. So this is, you literally got to put them in the room and throw away the key. Probably have a lot of coffee. But you need a prolonged, you really need an ongoing conversation. The stakes are enormous and there are competing considerations here that have to be brought into it.
Cyber is only one of the agenda items that you emphasize that we should be focusing on: global health, climate change. Could you say something about either any one of those additional issues you'd like to address or why you picked the spectrum of them going forward? What's the commonality about those issues and why do you think they're so important?
Look, I just came up with virtually every manifestation of globalization I could think of. And so, I think that's the defining, every age of history has its defining characteristic. For much of the 20th century, the defining driver, determinant of history was great power confrontation. I do not think that is necessarily the defining driver. Indeed, it better not become one. It could be an overlay, but I believe the real defining characteristic of this era are all these problems of globalization, proliferation to terrorism, to climate, and so forth. So, let's talk about climate for a minute, because it's obviously been in the news. A lot of people in the new administration are either skeptical of the science or worse. But I actually think the Paris Agreement was reached 14 or so months ago. I think it's quite an imaginative agreement. What it basically did, unlike previous global get-togethers, it didn't try to establish a single system for dealing with this. Like, the world can only produce this much, and let's set up a market scheme for trading shares, or that we're going to have a global price of carbon. Rather than having a top-down approach, it took a bottom-up approach, and it basically said, each sovereign state, it's up to you to decide what a five-year goal is for yourself. What's your trajectory? Where are you going to be in greenhouse gases, given your energy situation, your economic growth plans, and so forth? Give us your best efforts pledge. Live up to that, maybe do better than it. And then it said, second of all, let's get a pot of money to help those who need to adapt to the already baked into the cake consequences and effects of climate change. And what I like about this approach is it works with sovereign states. It's not a threat to their independence of action. And it may not be ambitious enough for some, I get that, and indeed it's not. And even if it were if all the current goals were met, it still wouldn't resolve the problem by a long shot. But it is the first successful international effort on climate at that level in modern history. And I think it shows a rather imaginative approach. And indeed, I hope this administration, which is again skeptical of this, comes around to seeing this as something it ought to embrace. Because this is a form of multilateralism that again works with sovereignty rather than against it.
We have only five more minutes in our time together. The next question is, if you are opposed to sanctions against Russia, what penalty do you think we should impose for their interference in our elections?
I'm not opposed to sanctions against Russia per se. And indeed, before we lift any on Ukraine, I believe it should only be linked to changes in Russian behavior. I don't believe we should simply go ahead and lift sanctions on the hope the Russians will change. I think it ought to be explicit. I just think as In my experience in government, there's a crisis. What happens? So you meet in the Situation Room at the White House, and there's a menu of options. And there's a kind of don't do very much option, and there's the go to war option. And what invariably happens is, let's choose that safe middle ground called sanctions. And it becomes the all-purpose choice. And my own view is we often ask too much of it. I've done several books on it, and second of all, sanctions can have some unintended consequences. They can often help non-market authoritarian governments keep control over the economies and societies. They can discourage the growth of middle classes. They can, again, reduce the degree to which a country is integrated into the regional or global economy, which again then frees it up in certain ways. So my view is simply don't always think of sanctions as the all-purpose cure. Because again, it often can't accomplish what you want. Last I checked, despite all the sanctions, the Russians are still sitting in Crimea and they're threatening parts of eastern Ukraine. And it has some negative consequences. Now, in the case of, it might be what I would have argued for doing more to help Ukraine with defensive arms. I would say we should have reacted to that Russian aggression by doing more to help the Baltic members of NATO. Think about what your responses are. It doesn't always, but all I'm saying is sanctions are one tool in the diplomatic bag. It's not necessarily the right tool for every situation.
I also thought it was striking that Jack Lew, the former Secretary of the Treasury, gave a speech emphasizing that our over-reliance on sanction is actually incentivizing countries to come up with alternative payment systems and diminishing the role of the dollar in the international order. So in addition to this terrific packed house we have here at the Marines Memorial tonight on behalf of the World Affairs Council, we also have a Facebook Live conversation going on this. And our last question is from Lenora on Facebook Live. Regarding Gorbachev's comment that it appears the world is preparing for war, what are your thoughts?
So you write a book called The World in Disarray, and everybody accuses you of being downbeat. And then you hear comments like that, and you go, wow, I didn't realize I was the optimist in the room. So I want to thank you for... let me say a couple of things. One I mentioned before, that there's very little about the future that's inevitable. So when I hear people say we're heading for war, or war's an impossibility, neither's true. There's a lot that's within the scope of policymakers to get right or to get wrong. I do think, though, that the last couple of years, we've lost ground. The analogy I use is if there were a share of stock called World Peace or World Order, Inc., it would have suffered a correction or a bear market. It's lost some altitude over the last couple of years. We see it in the Middle East, obviously. Europe, what's going on in Europe would have been unimaginable 4 or 5 years ago, the degree of uncertainty over Europe's future. The United States and China, friction over the South China Sea, question now about the one-China relationship. Just tell an anecdote. I was in China about a month ago, and it was the day before all this came out about the phone call with Taiwan. I've been going to China, I don't know, for over 30 years, and traditionally when you meet with Chinese diplomats, there's always a little bit about Taiwan, anyone else who's worked in the U.S. government. We remember this because Chinese diplomats, essentially, it was the equivalent of diplomatic station identification. People had to make the points about Taiwan, and the note takers would carefully take them down. This time was the first time in my memory I'd ever had extensive high-level meetings with China where it didn't come up. It was as if the issue had been sufficiently massaged that each side had other concerns. Needless to say, that would no longer be the case if I were to return to China today. So you've got Taiwan issues, you've got North Korea issues, you've got South China Sea issues. We haven't talked at all about India-Pakistan. There's that set of issues which is not doing very well. So my point is simply that I think things have deteriorated. Again, it's why I chose, in part I wrote this book as something of a warning. I do think that things have objectively deteriorated, and whether it's a number of regional crises, and as well as the overlay of great power relations, have also gotten somewhat worse. And my view is simply that things don't get better by themselves. To use a scientific parallel, the natural state of things is entropy. It's greater randomness. It's less order. And we have got, and so we can't just assume it's all going to sort itself out. It won't. And what the history of the last 70 years or 75 years tells me is the best sorter outer, not acting alone, but acting with others, is the United States. And what worries me is that in the aftermath of the Iraq and Afghanistan thing, there's a bit of fatigue about the world. And we saw, in particular, the last administration, I think will be seen historically on the side of those who retrenched to some extent, who did less. And as I said, you know, we talked about, not acting can be every consequence of acting. And this administration is after, in just 10 days or so, has shown that it is willing, that it's basically more of a disruptor than a preserver. And that's very odd to me, because I would have thought that a lot of the world order that we have was worth preserving, whether it's the international trading order or the alliance system and so forth. And it seems to be rejecting that, again, because it sees more costs than benefits, and is putting into play, it's almost a little bit like the healthcare analogy. I see a lot more repeal than I see replace. So it's not obvious to me, what is the replace when it comes to order in the world? And I believe it's got to be U.S.-led, but I think we just have to be very careful about tearing down what has worked without having a really clear, rigorously thought through understanding of what would take its place, and that would be both feasible and preferable. And I am unpersuaded.
Rigorous.
Yeah, rigorous, yeah, we like that. And I am just unpersuaded that it's there. So, I'll say one last story, and then I'll stop, which is when I used to have the Middle East account at the White House working for George Bush the father. Someone said, well, what are you trying to do in this job? And I said, oh, that's simple. I want to make the Middle East boring. And as you can see, I failed miserably. So what's happened is the Middle East has gotten way too interesting. Europe has gotten interesting again. The last time Europe was interesting, it was not a happy story. I do not want to see Europe interesting again. Asia has been remarkably stable. Despite all these powerful, wealthy countries and powers, it's worked out. Why? Because the United States has been basically the balancer there. And because we were there, countries like Japan and Korea didn't need to proliferate in certain ways or take matters into their own hand. China's been, to some extent, dissuaded from doing certain things. I don't think that's a system that works well by itself. And again, there's all these global issues. So, I am concerned by a United States that disrupts a lot of the arrangements of the world. It's a combination of turning inward in some or changing tack on others. And I just think we have to be extremely careful, because we don't want to make the world interesting again in ways that historical forces start gaining momentum. And I think we are potentially on the verge of doing that. So my sense is we have to be extremely mindful of the risks of going in that direction.
Won't you join me in thanking Richard Haass for this?
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was in conversation with Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.